leaving no one behind.
This online talk series is titled Leaving No One Behind, and it is brought to you by the House of African Feminisms, which is a Goethe Institute project in Southern Africa. In this series of talk, we seek to explore intersectionality in African feminism. To all of you joining us, welcome everybody.
It is a pleasure to have Françoise on this formal chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And hello, everybody.
Let's start with intersectionality. What does it mean for you, Françoise?
Okay, starting with the big question. There's a formal definition of intersectionality as the recognition and taking into account that we live lives in which we experience intersecting, overlapping, and mutually reinforcing oppressions, right? And I think it's a very important thing to formalize, to theorize, but many of us have experienced it. I think the fact that Kimberly Crenshaw was able to put it into a theory is validating of those experiences. I think many of us who work the feminist journey, sometimes we find the theory and we're like, aha, I knew there was something there. Yes. I think for me, that has been a very helpful concept to, in a way, validate experiences, but also guide the way we answer some of the, how do you respond to some of the things that we are told. It's also been, for me, something that guides my response as a feminist, as I think about the work that I do, whether it's narrative work, which I've done with Ayala, or even funding work and movement building work that I'm also doing with the African Women's Development Fund. I think it's been really key for me to have that. Not just so that, as you said, we don't leave anybody behind or anybody's a part of anybody's life behind, because sometimes that's what happens.
Yeah.
I do some work or program work that is about, that addresses this part of your work. I recognize a quarter of the oppressions that you experience and I invalidate the rest. So it's a guide as well for me. And lastly, it's a continuous learning.
Let's talk about Ayala for a bit. What was going through your mind? What were the dreams that were nourishing setting up this platform? What were you thinking about? How did it come about?
Yeah. So interestingly, Ayala didn't come out a dream. It came out of frustration and it came out of curiosity. I was frustrated. So before then, I had been working in the field of ending child marriage for quite a while, actually. I did that work for about 8 years. And I did that in the context of a coalition building exercise of a global partnership to end child marriage, which is called Girls Not Bride. And my role there was really bringing people together on the continent with strong collective agendas, you know, so we'd have all this. You know what we do, right? In this meeting, this work, where we bring people together, talk about the issues, we talk about the policies, we talk about, you know, all of these things, the projects, the initiatives, the organizations. Mm-hmm. And for me, there were two sets of frustrations around that, as, alongside all the achievements and the beautiful things that came out of it. The first thing was, I personally, in my personal journey, I didn't study feminism. I didn't even study gender studies. That was not my expertise at all. It all started with a work assignment. Somebody said, okay, this is what your work is now. And I was like, okay, sure. Mm. And it became a revelation for me when I understood that all the pieces of work that we do, we talk about, they're often about issues, but they're like the symptoms of the same, you know, like poor disease that is patriarchy. And once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And once I'd seen it, I dedicated to put all of my energy, orient my career on this. But in those conversations, as somebody who understood that there were politics behind the policies that we were advocating for at the African Union and with government and all that, I was like, so where is the space for the conversation about that? And those fabulous people, feminists that I work with, where is the space for having conversations, not just about what they do, but about who they are, what they experience? And actually, our formal spaces of organizing, which are in a very NGO-ized kind of work, that isn't, there's no space for that. You know, you look at the agenda of the meetings we go to, there's no space for it, right?
No,
and
no.
so those were the accidental conversations that I would try to foster at the lunch break. You know, I was very invasive. I was asking very personal questions to people I didn't even know, because I was like, so why are you, and who are you, and why are you who you are? And what guides you? What drives you? What experiences? I had this intuition from spending time with them that feminism was something that is embodied, but there was no conversation for that. So I grew in my feminism by through the conversations with them. And I was frustrated that there was no space for those conversations. So I decided to create a space for myself. And once I had the space, I was like, well, if I'm interested, surely I'm not the only one. And so sharing is caring, as they say.
You set up a room or a space with mats, and you were like, you know, let's just sit and just talk. Was it how it first started? Yes.
You know, Ayana was just the conversations. And then I was going to Women Deliver, a huge, massive conference, Women Deliver. I think it was in 2020 in Canada. Okay. And I wanted to go, and I was going. And I was like, wouldn't it be nice if we had that kind of conversation in person? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had never done anything like this. I didn't have any money. I didn't even know how much it cost. And I spoke about it with somebody I really want to acknowledge. Her name is Ramatou Bangoura. And she's from Sierra Leone and living in the US. And she was working in philanthropy at the time in a foundation. We were talking about this project that she was working on, and she wanted to get more information about Francophone Africa. And I said to her, you know, if I manage to pull this off, I would like you to come. And then she was like, tell me more about your idea. And I explained about Ayala and my idea for what has become the circles. And she called me back a week later, and she said, I'm going to give you, I think, $1,500 so that you can do this circle. And nobody had, that was the first experience of philanthropy. Nobody had ever given me money to put an idea to work. And I was like, oh, wow. And so I had this plan for doing something serious, right? Like, they give me money. I'm a serious person. I have to say this. I'm a very serious person. I take things, my responsibilities very seriously. She gave me money. I have this idea. I'm going to do this seriously. So it was a very serious round table situation that I was thinking about. And after a couple of days of Women Deliver, I was like, this place is exhausting. I mean, it's rich, but, you know, like, you have to put on that performance of showing that you're smart, that you know your stuff, and you're wearing high heels, and you're wearing makeup, and you're tired. People are talking, I'm an introvert, people are talking
you
to
are
me
on
all
point.
Day. I was like, I'm done with this. I don't know if I can hold this space. And I started asking people who are there registered, what do you need of this space? And they said, please, I don't want people to stress me out. I don't want people to talk in big English. I don't want any of these things. I just want to come connect with people at a very deep level, intimate level. An hour before the event started, I called the venue. These people were still be cursing my name. I was like, remove everything. Remove everything. We just put chairs in a circle. I went and bought some gifts. I went and bought some bowls. You know those bowls we use for the circles where everybody is in charge of noting down what resonates for them. And I just, I had this flash moment of saying, we don't need another one of the highly scripted, highly curated spaces. And I said, let's just make it a come as you are and connect as you are moment. And so we had a discussion about feminist sisterhood, and it was fantastic. It was fantastic because when people understood that they could let their guard down and just be, I mean, people were sitting on the floor, no shoes. People were eating chicken wings while, you know, sitting on the floor. And it allowed people to have a level of connection and vulnerability because the performance was not required. Then it went so deep, so quickly. People who didn't really know each other, and I don't know. I mean, people were crying. I was like, well, AI circles, people are always crying. And I remember this woman who I didn't know, and she started crying. I said to her, why are you crying? And she said, I'm just crying because it's so nice. And then that was it. The circles were born, and they are wonderful. They really are wonderful. And I'm glad to see that it's also a practice that I see more being done more and more in our sector, in our movement.
Ayala means that which is spoken, yeah? So it is conversations. And I know that you are very big. It is not so much on translation, but you want to create those linkage. What we talked about book earlier on, the fact that knowledge wasn't being produced much in French, which is the language that we have. Why was it so important for you to connect feminists from everywhere? I mean, when you go onto the Ayala website, you have feminists from Tunisia, from from South Africa, from Côte d'Ivoire, from everywhere, working as in feminist organization, working as artist, working, you know, why was it so important for you to have so many different profiles?
So one of the things I wanted to achieve with Eyala was to paint a mosaic of what it means to be an African feminist today. That was actually the first tagline that I had created. For one reason was that people kept telling us feminism is a Western import. And I was like, well, I don't believe this because of the feminists I know. So I know that's not true. And I thought it was because there was like this, people had created a template of what being a feminist meant, and they will just lock you into this. And I had this experience of being in conversation with people who showed that if you consider feminism as something that is embodied, then every single one of us is embodying feminism and redefining feminism in their own way. And so I was interested in the mosaic of it.
You managed as a one-woman band, Eyala, for the first 2 years before getting a collective in 2021, I think. But for the first 2 years, I mean, you know, Eyala wasn't feeding you, so you had to do it all by yourself. And knowledge production is kind of, you know, it is not a project that you are doing, inviting 150 people. We are doing this, we are doing this. It is knowledge production. We don't know exactly. So you didn't really have funding, did you?
The first few years, I did it without external funding. I basically, it was self-funded. And for me, when I think about resources, I'm not just talking about money, right? I'm talking about time, I'm talking about skills, I'm talking about also people you coming in. I have a friend who said, I have time, I can help you with translation. I can, you know, so in a way, yes, it took a lot of resources and not all of them were financial. It took a lot of patience. I think about how Eyala and this journey has affected my family, for example, right? Because this journey of being in conversation, the questions you ask other people are the questions that you end up asking yourself, and then reflecting on it and be like, well, if feminism is embodied, how am I embodying it as somebody who has come to feminism through work, right? So taking aside the reports and whatever projects, how this journey has affected my life, my family relationships, my parenting,
My
my
being a sibling,
marriage,
though.
my siblings, my marriage, my sex life, my everything has been also part of that journey, you know, and it's been a very clarifying, very enriching, and it has been my most aligned experience where the work, the self, the growth, the passion, the talent was most aligned. And yeah, I'm glad I listened to that idea.
And then transitioning from the one woman band who did everything to a collective in 2021, how was that?
Well, there were two drivers to this. The first one was I got really exhausted in 2020 because of the pandemic. So I found myself being at home, like all of us. I hear a lot of people talking about the lockdown as a moment of great creativity and liberation. And for me, it was terrible. I was stuck in the house with two kids, these tiny humans eating six meals a day, so
They do
dirty. You
eat
have to.
a
I was like, I don't have time to do any of this translation work, you know? And so I could feel that I just didn't have enough time. Like I needed like five, six pairs of hands to do the work. And so I could already feel like there was a problem with the sustainability. And then I applied for a job and I got it. And I knew that I couldn't, because I'm such a serious person, I knew I couldn't seriously do both. So actually in considering whether to take my job here at African Women's Development Fund, one of the huge considerations was I cannot take this job if I don't know for sure that somebody can take over. Yeah. So those were the drivers. So I did the work of looking for funding, applying for a fund, and I think, yes, the Foundation for a Just Society took a chance and gave Eyala a significant grant that allowed me to hire a team. So it's been an exercise of letting go, of entrusting people with the spirit of something, not just the body of something, but really, and just accepting that it is, they're going to take it, whatever happens is the best that could have happened. It was actually evolving Eyala into a collective endeavor with a team and a group of strategic advisors.
You are very also, as well as, you know, language, as well as connecting, you are big on sisterhood. And I like you always use this word, intentional sisterhood. What does it mean to do sisterhood intentionally as opposed?
Yeah, I would say that I'm big on community, big on solidarity, sisterhood, and I mean this in a feminist political sense. I understand we had this conversation at the ALA with the team at whether sisterhood in itself is exclusive of non-binary people, people who wouldn't accept to be called a sister. I think about it in a political term of building community. So what I mean by being intentional about that, however you call it, what I mean is that in the work that we do, and I would say many other ecosystems as well, there's this assumption that solidarity, community, sisterhood, the togetherness comes as a byproduct, automatic byproduct of us having similar goals, having similar politics, showing up in similar spaces. But the truth is that doesn't make us together. That just makes us along each other. But being in the same space, even having the same goals, doesn't make us together. Yet I strongly believe that the agenda that we have, which is dismantling patriarchy and all the other oppressions that are so
Tentacles
linked to
as
it, the tentacles, right? So it requires for us to be together, not just to be aligned or coordinated, because those oppressions, they affect what we work on. But the thing about being a feminist, that the things that you try to achieve, you are trying to achieve them for society and for yourself, right? And so you can't do that alone. And also, there's just too many tentacles, right? Like I had this conversation in the first ALA circle in Dakar, where there was a woman who was from the DRC who was saying, I can't relate to the struggle of feminists who decide that what they will focus on is something so trivial as, I don't know what issues she had
What
singled
is
out, but
trivial?
she felt that there was something that was very trivial. So it was something like internet or something. And she said, but where I come from, women are being raped, you know, 5 times a day. And I just can't relate to that. But I think if the manifestations of patriarchy are so wide and diverse, that so must be our movements. And we need to be together. We need to know that we are doing this together. And yet we cannot just assume togetherness. We have to nurture it. And I often call it the glue. The glue that brings us together and makes our movement more than the sum of its parts. The parts being us as activists, our organizations, our projects, our advocacy, etc. What keeps us together is also what keeps us strength and resilience, knowing that I have your back and you have mine. And that is what keeps us. If you're not intentional about it, which means creating space for it, putting investments, resources, time, you know,
Awareness also.
your awareness, then it is not happening. There's no way we do this liberation thing without being together. It's not going to happen. And yet we refuse to invest in the togetherness. So there's some math that is not quite mathing there.
Yolande has asked, how do you balance nourishing yourself and yours, those children who eat 6 times a day, as you nourish the communities you are building? That is important.
Oh, thank you, Yolan. I cannot lie. I'm terrible at this. I see some of my colleagues are actually on this call who know this very well. I'm terrible at this. Terrible example of nourishing myself. I would be extremely arrogant to give any kind of advice on that. I do not do it properly, but I do try some things. I have a couple of practices that I do in terms of nourishing myself. For me, I nourish myself best in silence because I'm an introvert and people talk too much. And I have a very extroverted life and job. So I cultivate silence. I disappear as much as I can. And one of the ways I do this consistently, I've been doing since 2017, is that I take a week, a year, where I disappear. I don't take anybody. I don't take any work. I take some music, some books, a notebook, and I just listen to myself. And that is actually when the idea for ALA came to life. The second way I do it is therapy. I'm big on therapy because as a way of systematizing a time for self-reflection. So not as a curative thing per se, because I mean, I probably have some things to cure, but that's not my approach to it. It's really like once a week for an hour, the focus is nourishing myself, all right? And so just some small, for me, the small practices of quietness have been very helpful. Now, do I eat properly? No. Do I eat well? Not so, as much as I should. Do I sleep properly? No. Do I work out? No. But I'm working on that too.
Oh, workout.
2025
I need
is
to get
my
I need to
year.
get into
I've been saying this every year since 2020. It's not my fault that the world is the way it is. Thank you for the question, Matida. On movement building specifically, my brain is turning to a book that is not about movement building, but has been very helpful for me. I love Mona El Tahawi, who is a feminist writer from Egypt. And she has this book called The Seven Necessary Sins of Women. I love that book because it really pokes holes in the respectability politics that we have and that are imposed on us. So she lists seven necessary sins: anger, ambition, taking space. And I think it's important for movement building because I think the way we are being as a sector trained to do movement building has been very sanitized, right? Going back to this idea of performance, you have to show up a certain way because that's how you get the job. Because that's how you get the access. And I fully know that for some reason, I know how to do those things. This is the way I was trained, professionally. And so there's an expectation of me and a lot of us in this world to show up like stripped of all the emotions that took us into this world in the first place. We are not feminists because we are pacifiers. We are angry about the world and we have huge ambitions for it, But once we are in the world and they're like, oh, now you have to be also respectable and polite.
We are seeing also a lot of spaces that are being built at the moment. We have even here in Côte d'Ivoire where I sit, I see feminists, for instance, like Carrie Laetitia Gouly, who has set up like a platform where she gives out information about the law, and she set up a feminist library at the moment. Is it because we have we are internalizing the fact that we are doing all of this rush, 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 but we need to be taking time to being with our ourself, to understanding more, to reading more, or
I think that's good. It's not competition. It's emulation is good. I think that's really great. And I think that people, as they do it, are slightly worried, especially in the French-speaking part of the continent, which is where I'm worrying more about it, but not just. I worry a little bit about people grabbing the label of feminists and grabbing it, parading it, holding on to being called a feminist and putting more energy there than on the work. And that is a big worry for me. I'm very worried about it, especially in a time when a lot of the work is done on social media. And social media, and not just capitalism as well, but particularly social media, it's trying to make heroes out of individuals, like single out some of us as individuals, but in movement, there are no heroes.
Thank you so much for everything that you do, not only with Ayala, but with AWDF and by being a supporter for the rest of us in the community.
Thank you for having me in this
No.
space. And thanks. I really love the work of the House of African Feminism. I'm grateful to have a couple of opportunities to contribute to it. So thank you all for doing this. I can't wait to see the collection of the talks. Looking forward to that. And thank you to everybody who showed up. Bye bye.
Thank you, ciao.